So welcome, guys. Max is the accidental engineer here. Today, for those of you guys who don't know who this is Josh Staples, who's... do you mind sharing your title and where you're at?
Right now, I work at a company called Twilio. Twilio is probably most well-known for essentially aggregating SMS traffic. We have a lot of great APIs that are really easy to implement for voice, video chat, SMS. I specifically am a solutions architect for the Authy group. Authy is a turnkey solution for second factor authentication.
So would you say you're on a team of salespeople or on a team of engineers? Or
great question. So this is actually my first gig as a sales engineer slash solutions architect. And I work with about a dozen sales guys, a couple other solutions architects. And it's a neat job, a lot of variety.
So in contrast to all your previous gigs, you've been in this business for a while, so
yeah.
What's the difference with the sales engineer type of role?
Right. So one of the reasons I went into sales engineering is I was a little bored with the way engineering is very boilerplate, right? So you have a project, you have a Jira list, you break up your tasks, and then you work on a two-week sprint, one-week sprint, everything else.
So for those people who might not even know what a sprint is, do you mind breaking down like what it's like at some of the roles you've been at previously where there's a really high level of process about how software gets made?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I guess ideally one of the things you have to look at when you're designing software, designing projects, is the actual cost associated with an engineer. One of the easiest ways to minimize this cost and to maximize sort of their implementation time is to break down projects, right? If you're going to build a skyscraper, you're going to break it down in steps, starts on the steps, organize the steps, and build that skyscraper appropriately, right? You're going to start off with the frame, which could be some basic top-level architecture, and then slowly get into the details of, you know, implementing each floor, adding designs, desks, and everything else. So typically in engineering, you take a while and actually design a sprint. You'll have people that actually run these sprints. Sprints is essentially a time-boxed amount of time. It could be 1 week, it could be 2 week. It really depends upon the engineering team. It could be even longer. And essentially, you break down the tasks and then assign the tasks based upon the how difficult they are and the amount of time it'll take to the engineers on your team. And then the engineers will start on a sprint and actually iterate through these tasks and slowly develop whatever project, whatever kind of design they're working on.
So if we were working for Reddit.com and making the website from scratch, we might be on a team together and have 2 weeks to do a set of designated tasks for each of us. So I might make the login form, Josh might make the voting functionality, right. And so you break up the work, kind of like building a skyscraper, like you said.
And it's also not just engineers, though. You also have designers that will come in. A lot of time before you can actually do any work, you have to have designers create copy for you. You have to get that approved by marketing. So there's a real sort of step-by-step iterative process that you need to go through before you can actually do any work. But then once you're actually doing the work, typically you only have to do it once because it's been thought through thoroughly, and everybody's on board at that point.
So one of the most interesting things I think about when I consider the role you have now versus all the previous roles you've had is that as a typical software engineer, you probably are compensated with salary and some amount of equity in the company that employs you. So in your most recent role, in your role currently, how is that different? Do you mind sharing? You don't need to name numbers, but
no,
like
it's fine.
That's a significant difference between the role
it,
you're in.
It is significantly different. Typically, a sales guy, let's say just for numbers' sake, a sales guy in San Francisco might have a base salary of $70,000, right? And then what they'll have is they'll have essentially goals, either quarterly or monthly. It really depends upon the company, or even yearly in some locations, where you actually have to hit that goal to achieve these sort of pay points, right? A good salesman in San Francisco in tech can do $250,000 a year. That's if they're hitting all their points and everything else. Sales engineering is a little different, where we have a much higher base salary, but we still have that kind of bonus structure. My bonus structure is about 25% of my base salary. So it's a little different, but it's still better than engineering, in my opinion.
So this is one of the things that I can totally understand about why you choose why you would elect to change the type of role you're working in, is that at week after week, sprint after sprint, you kind of go through the grind of collecting the salary, collecting the paycheck, and slowly vesting whatever equity you've got. So are there any caps on your earning potential as a sales engineer?
There are caps. Mostly sales engineers, the entire sales team has a goal for the year, or in our case, a quarter. And if you hit that cap, and then if you go above that cap, you start getting multipliers. So a really, really good salesman in many companies is going to be the highest paid salesperson, or the highest paid person in that entire company if they're hitting their multipliers. So say, just for numbers purposes, say I had a goal of $100,000 for a quarter. Let's say I scored $300,000, right? So that might put a 4x multiplier on my actual sales payment. So instead of getting the $70,000 or whatever for that quarter, all of a sudden I'm making $200,000 for that 3 months of work. So there are a lot of great multipliers. But again, like as a sales engineer, it's a little different. In my team, we actually support all the salespeople. So sometimes salespeople are divided up into individual regions. Sometimes they have individual products. Our sales guys are regionalized. But then all the sales engineers, there are three of us, and there's one in APAC, so four total. We're actually there to support everyone. So our numbers are actually aggregated across all the sales guys' regions at this current time.
Sounds socialist.
Well, it's really good because it allows, for me, like I've done a lot of the demo sites, I've done a lot of work that isn't specific to a certain sales guy, but supports all the salespeople across the way, right? A lot of those are banking. We have a demo banking site, for example. That's something that each salesperson will use, which I've been able to provide for all of them because I support all the sales guys. If I were siloed to a particular region and a particular salesperson, I would only want to work specifically on the tasks that help that person because it's reflected in my comp.
So is the role of a sales engineer or a solutions architect something that a recent college graduate is an eligible candidate for? Or is it something, are these types of roles and these teams only looking for candidates that have like the number of years experience as a software engineer that you did when you found this role?
Yeah, great question. So it could go either way. For me, I actually knew my boss from a previous job about 8 years ago. And I'd always admired I admired the guys as a boss and as a person. And we had talked quite some time, and he had interacted with me. I was essentially adding an SSO product to a medical university at the time. And it was their company that I was working with. And he came down to fix one problem that ended up having to do with cryptography keys, but it was a really obtuse, weird problem, and we always kept in touch with that. He was impressed at the time. I like to think he's still impressed. but we had been talking constantly, and we'd always had a beer whenever he'd come out. So this is a network connection I made 8 years ago. And finally, I kind of felt that it was time to transition, so I reached out to him, and he had just transferred from Oracle to Twilio, named Dan Kilmer. Hi, Dan. And he reached out and got me on board, and I really enjoy it. Part of the fun of working with a sales group too is there is a lot of character, right? It's a lot of charisma. These people are talkers, they're communicators. They have a lot of wonderful soft skills, which typically as an engineer you don't get. So that's one of the things I'm benefiting from, is I get to see this excellent communication, excellent process handling that typically you wouldn't see in a general engineering group.
So as far as, do you guys hire people out of their bachelor's programs, or
we do have some people. So there's another sales engineering group at Twilio. Our sales engineering group is specific to Authy, and we're generally much older. We're a more mature group. Everyone has 15, 20 years of experience. Many other sales engineers, one of the basic requirements is communication. You can learn the technical stuff. It's really hard to get up and stand up in front of people to go in and shake hands with the CEO or CTO if you're generally kind of afraid of that kind of interaction. But you can absolutely get into a sales engineering role at like a junior level. And it's completely doable. I guess generally though, you have to show some aptitude for technical skill, some aptitude for communication, be able to present be able to write emails that people can read through, and in general, just be able to sit down at a desk, get work done, and to please customers at the end of the day.
So going way back in time to when you were in undergrad getting your bachelor's degree, what was that in?
So I got my bachelor's in computer engineering at Clemson University.
Yep. And was that, did you find your first job to be a direct result of what you majored in, or did you go into something right. non-computer engineering first? Or?
Great question. So I actually, even in undergrad, I was a little torn with computer engineering. It's a very engineering brain kind of thing. And I consider myself a little bit more worldly than that. I did some international internships during undergrad and realized that I really didn't want to go into building helicopter missiles for the military after graduation.
For sure.
just DOD work in general. If you're a government contractor right now, all I can say is get out. Just get out. The world's far more fulfilling outside of government contracting. So I realized later in undergrad that I was just really kind of bored with engineering. I barely slid out. I wasn't even studying for finals near the end. And I ended up returning immediately to grad school. I ended up joining a brand new 3D program at Clemson University called Digital Production Arts. And I got a Master of Fine Arts in Digital Production Arts. Typically, people with this degree are the ones that go to Pixar, Blue Sky, ImageWorks, these kind of organizations.
So working on movies or video games? Or?
Yeah, video games, movies. So essentially, in our program, we learned Maya, which is now an Autodesk product, and another program called Max.
That's for 3D.
For 3D design, generation, modeling. We learn a bunch of other programs, too, just for compositing, video editing, and the like. It was a long program. I ended up building a really cheap, homemade motion capture system for my graduate thesis. And got that published, and then I finished, and I was looking around, and typically when you go through that program, you start off at one of these big animation firms where you're working third shift as a render wrangler. A render wrangler is someone who comes in after the rendering has been done all night. Essentially, they take all the renderings, put them together, and set them up in sort of movies for the directors and producers and animators to come in the morning to review to see if they've done everything. So working third shift in LA for 4 years did not seem too appealing to me. So I started looking around. I've been making websites for 20, 25 years now. And I ended up applying to a couple jobs in Charleston, South Carolina, where I'm originally from. And in Charleston is an organization called NOAA. NOAA is essentially the weather people, right? The satellites, the buoys that are sitting out there. It seemed like a very interesting first job. Like, if your first job on your resume is admittedly a government organization, but it's NOAA or NASA or something like that, that is going to catch that recruiter's eye, like, right off the bat. So I ended up working for NOAA, and they were able to let me actually set up a rendering farm internally. I did some of my own rendering for NOAA, got on the Weather Channel, It Could Happen Tomorrow, and we sort of, I did a lot of different stuff. I was also doing web stuff at the same time. The thing is when I took that job, I was making $37,000 a year, mm-hmm. right? So if I had gone and gotten an engineering degree right after undergrad, I could have made probably 60, right, immediately. So here I am, I've taken an additional 4 years, I've taken a job at far below what I could have made as an engineer, but it looked cool, right? Mm-hmm. And it was cool. There are a lot of neat parts about NOAA. It was a great organization. I was working with really smart, compassionate people, which isn't something you're going to get in some kind of web design firm, right? But I was also able to use a lot of my very various skills to actually help them out. So I worked there for about a year and a half and got a little bored. At this particular organization of NOAA I worked at, we had this joke where once you got voted Employee of the Month, you go out and find a new job. So I got Employee of the Month and went out and found a new job. I ended up working at a startup called Belief Networks. They were bought out by a company called Benefit Focus. During the startup, it was actually about time when the real estate crash hit.
It was 2008.
And it caused a lot of problems with funding and everything else. I happened to be working with a fellow who was from the medical university where I met Dan, my current boss, a while back. And I really, really appreciated his sort of unique skill sets, right? I've been using Unix or Linux or POSIX or whatever for years in undergrad, but it was on like a Sun Microsystems OS. It wasn't Ubuntu. It wasn't Red Hat. It was just, it was
these
a bit
are
of a
all,
pain.
These are all different versions of Linux that have
right.
their own tweaks. And
yeah.
By and large,
flavors.
Are very similar. Yeah.
Yeah, so I saw what he was able to do, and I really appreciated his skill set. I also knew that he had left the medical university, and there was an open position still for his position, so I ended up applying to that position, used him as a reference, and I got in. At that point, I spent about 3 years in at the medical university as like a special projects guy. I did a lot of a product called Shibboleth, which is a federated identity management system. A lot of single sign-on projects. This is a huge university. I think something like 10,000 beds at that point, which is a huge hospital. And there's a teaching university too, so there's all kinds of different situations you could be involved in. I did, at that point, after about 3 years, I was getting a little bored again. It was a cubicle farm kind of environment. I knew I'd gotten the skill set I wanted from this location, and I decided to move to the East Coast, or West Coast, from the East Coast. I landed out here in San Francisco about 6 or 7 years ago. I've been doing great. I have a lot of variety of employment that has landed me here now at Twilio.
So one of the cooler technical problems I heard you mention was about rendering farms. So I think a lot of our audience might not be familiar with what a rendering farm
right.
is. You mentioned it in two instances, one in the context of what you might have been working on if you had gone to work for a Pixar, for example. And you also mentioned setting up a rendering farm in your time at NOAA. So do you mind kind of giving a layman's explanation of what a rendering farm is?
Sure. So all of this work happened before the AWS cloud, right? So when you're actually doing high-level 3D renderings, you can spend several minutes rendering a single frame. Right. If there are 60 frames or 30 frames to an actual second worth of footage, then all of a sudden you've got, 30 times, let's say, 3 minutes a frame. It's 90 minutes or one single second a frame.
So even more general than that, this is in regards to making an animated video. So
yep.
In an animated video, you have maybe 60 frames per second. So that's 60 different image files that you need to draw. And not just draw computationally, but you need to write that to a hard disk somewhere.
Yep.
So that later, what you can do is you can stitch together all, or glue together all of the images into 60 frames per second so that you end up with a playable video.
Exactly.
So
yep.
what does the AWS cloud have to do with this?
So rendering farms, at NOAA specifically, we had a couple labs. And Maya had a particular client that you could put on the labs. And essentially what it would do is you'd have a master node that would send out all these rendering jobs to individual nodes. So all of a sudden I go from having one machine at my desk that can render this at 3 minutes a frame to having, say, 100 machines that can render each frame individually, then aggregate them all back together, right?
So if you had a job that took an hour on one computer, and instead of running it on your one computer, you distributed it to 100 different computers, that would reduce the time it takes to render from 60 minutes down to 60 minutes divided by 100.
Yeah.
So you get a 100x performance increase. Instead of waiting around an hour, you're waiting around a minute.
Right.
So.
And so these render farms that all the 3D companies work with, they might still do this as well. They would build out huge server farms that someone would run. And essentially, their animators or developers would be able to take these big 3D projects, set them up to actually render while the actual producers are asleep, and then show back up in the morning and have all this work done. So it's a great way to distribute load. AWS is essentially the same concept. It's just a cloud. The render farms were, I suspect, the original cloud, 10, 15 years ago.
So back in the day, if you were a company that wanted to parallelize the rendering of your video, you would have to go out and buy 100 computers. So
yeah.
Amazon Web Services allows you to, on demand, rent 100 computers and only pay for the time that you're using them, and then say, I'm no longer interested in renting these, and turn them off.
Exactly.
Right?
Yep.
So,
but even then, AWS could be more expensive than actually building out your own farm.
Yeah.
There are a lot of considerations there. I've worked at one particular company that did exactly that. They're in some of the highest cost per square foot area in San Francisco, but they still found it cheaper to do their task by building a render farm, hiring someone to maintain it, and then do it themselves, than to actually go to AWS. So this is something you have to consider when you're doing this calculation. If you're a small company, have a minimal number of requirements, it might be cheaper in the short term to go with AWS. Longer term, you probably want to build out your own space.
Cool, cool. So I know you personally from us having worked together. I know one of your most interested subjects is with regards to the future of virtual reality.
Yes.
And three-dimensional user interfaces. So do you mind sharing your early experiences with it and how you came to know about it and get excited about it?
Sure. So I guess the VR, AR angle, VR virtual reality, AR for augmented reality, those are the big things coming up right now, right? Everyone in tech is all gaga about it. So but back in the day, my 3D background, I got attuned to a lot of this. I understood what the actual problems were with motion capture. And then admittedly, I took an aside into web development and engineering and the like for a while. But here in San Francisco, there are a bunch of 3D people that are just pretty famous, right? When I first came out here, I met an author named Tony Parisi. He's the guy that actually co-invented VRML back in the mid-90s. So VRML is virtual reality markup language. It's like an XML for VR objects, right? This is the first concept to actually create something in 3D in a mock-up and have it appear in a web browser. So one other great thing about being in San Francisco is the meetups. They're well-funded. They're well-attended. You can go to these 3D WebGL meetups, meet people that are actually designing the spec, writing the spec from Firefox, from Google, from Apple, whomever, and actually shake hands with them, right? Get to know them. So I started meeting some of these people and got around, and I learned how to give presentations while at that government job, NOAA. And so I started giving a few presentations. I was also working at Autodesk at the time, so having that sort of double whammy of being able to present and also working at Autodesk, being able to talk 3D, I got to know a lot of people. So more recently, I've got a VR setup downstairs. Max has tried out. The room space HTC Vive is amazing. It is what you want to have, right? Oculus Rift, I mean, they're coming along. But part of the appeal is that when you think of augmented reality and virtual reality, it's essentially the same thing, right? The math is all the same. The motion of moving the head, positioning your hands, it's all the same math. The only difference is hardware. With virtual reality, you're wearing something over your face. You can't see it. You can't see anything beyond it because you're actually looking at the screens right here in front of you. With augmented reality, it's the same concept, but you're actually looking through something, right? So when you twist your head, whatever was right there should still be over there. Same with virtual reality. So pretty soon, we're going to see emergence. There's Magic Leap coming out. Apple just came out with the AR kit. So we're going to see an emergence of both VR, AR kind of conceptually and start being able to play and interface with the real world while in the real world via this augmented reality concept.
So there's tons of consumer type of applications you could imagine, but I know there's a lot of interest in trying to make money off of virtual reality and augmented reality technologies and hardware as soon as possible. So do you see any kind of applications of VR and AR in even your role as a sales engineer or solutions architect, like holding meetings with prospective customers, or I don't know?
So it's an interesting question. I'm not sure yet either, but mm-hmm. What I will say in my experience is that entertainment and gaming leads everything, right? Mm-hmm. So most of the way the web is today is because of entertainment and gaming. And by entertainment, I typically mean porn. So these are the two kind of fields that push the envelope. So right now, what we're seeing is gaming and porn in VR and AR, right? Hmm. What we're also seeing, though, is a movement towards architecture, like companies like Autodesk that are moving into actually augmented reality of, say, a foreman in a skyscraper can actually see where pipes are supposed to run, whereas in comparison to where they are actually running. So there is a lot of movement in that direction. But really, I haven't seen the killer app yet. Mm-hmm. If you guys want a good concept of this kind of augmented reality usage, there's a book by Werner Vinge called Rainbow's Inn. And he does a fantastic job of designing a world where this augmented reality system, it's this interactive system that you have to learn and grow up with, plays a role in society as a whole.
Got it. Awesome. Yeah. So not super immediate business-to-business type of applications for VR/AR, but largely entertainment and pleasure.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. Facts are facts. That's what it comes down to.
So now that you've taken a role in more sales engineer side of things, are there skills or technologies? I mean, we've talked about VR/AR, but are there skills and technologies that you're really looking forward to gaining at this point in your career?
Yeah, I'm definitely a little loose on communication. I hate proofreading emails, so I've had to start doing that. Mm. So that's primarily soft skills. I work with a few guys that are just absolutely amazing at it. They're effective communicators. They can present well, they can talk well, they can debate well. It's these soft skills where if you want to get in this kind of role, it's something you should focus on. If you have a hard time presenting, go take a class on how to present. It'll help out droves in the long term.
Is that something that you have done, or is that something you've learned all these, or are learning all these skills, like you say, on the job as a byproduct of having your job?
Yeah, so NOAA, the government organization I worked with, actually sponsored a presentation class. I'm drawing a blank right now.
That's okay.
Okay. So I actually took that class, Toastmasters. It was a Toastmasters class. And so I actually participated in that, and at one point became the president of Toastmasters. And that alone, like, I might not give the greatest presentations, but I give effective presentations, right? And you'll enjoy my presentations.
or else.
I'm also really good at just winging it, right? So a lot of what Toastmasters did is it made me less scared, less bashful of getting up in front of a group of people. It also teaches you things about moving your arms, talking effectively, taking change out of your pocket so you're not jingling your change the entire time, which I did during my thesis presentation. So it's a lot of little small steps like that. It's a good group, too, because typically everyone has to go through the same step-by-step process. I think the icebreaker is the first speech. And then it tells you, it sort of trains you in a bunch of different ways to give speeches. And you're in a group of peers, right? So everyone's very supportive. It's fun. We had a vote for the best Toastmasters in our organization, and they got a free coupon for lunch at a Chinese place everyone liked, right? So you can frame it effectively as well.
And they have clubs all over the United States. So if you just Google Toastmasters and your city name, odds are they're meeting at the local YMCA building or Chinese restaurant.
Yes.
So
yeah. That was probably the big takeaway that I learned. It was something I'd managed to avoid in undergrad and grad school. But fortunately, sort of NOAA helped me foster that in.
So a little tangential to this, but you were describing how you want to get better at the communication side of things in your sales engineer type of role. One interesting startup in the Bay Area recently announced raising something like $200 million at a very high valuation for the company called Grammarly, which provides an automated grammar checking. Do you use any kind of tools like that, or do the salespeople that you admire and are hoping to learn from, do they use these types of tools to automatically check themselves from sending that email that has maybe the wrong tone or misspellings or bad grammar?
I know the guys I directly work with don't. They're sort of pro level at this point. One of them, for example, is a former lawyer. I mean, so he's on point with his communication. The other guys are so a little bit older, and so they're just pros. They know what they're doing at this point. Mm. I specifically don't use anything other than Google. But typically, if I have an important email to write, I'll write it, reread it, and then essentially not put any... here's a good point for those junior developers. If you're writing an email, do not put an email address in the to or CC or BCC until you're completely done, right? That's one of the things you learn, is that accidentally hitting Control-Enter in a certain application will send an email. A badly formatted, half-finished email.
This can have catastrophic impact on your career prospects.
Yep.
Yeah.
So Essentially, what I'll do though is I'll write the email and then I'll go do something else for 5-10 minutes, come back and reread it, and then send it. Right?
Sounds like you have a story here. Do you mind sharing? I don't know if you do, but do you mind sharing a story of a...
Sure, I've got an email. So,
okay.
when I worked at the Medical University, I'm a graduate of Clemson University, which is one of two larger universities in South Carolina. The other one's USC, University of South Carolina. And we're competitors, you know, friendly competitors. Our football team beats their football team all the time. And so do most of our other sports teams. So when we're working at Medical University, I got an email from a friend who I knew was a electrical engineer graduate from USC. And then I proceeded to respond to him. I accidentally hit reply all, however, and this was a group email that went out, and proceeded to rip him apart, unintentionally doing this publicly, about how ineffective his engineering was. And this is all tongue-in-cheek. We're having just fun jabbing each other. But at Medical University of South Carolina at times using Outlook, and Outlook has this undo email send feature. And what that stupid undo send email feature actually does is it sends a notification to every single person that received that email saying that you're trying to retract the email. It doesn't actually retract the email. So previously, where everyone probably would have ignored it, because I sent this retract email feature, it essentially notified everyone to read the feature because there's something juicy there. So I immediately left for lunch and proceeded to walk down a corridor and heard at least a dozen people cracking up because of this inadvertent email I sent. So this wasn't too catastrophic. It was more egg in my face a little bit.
Yeah.
But it is something that you see a lot. People just not understanding email etiquette appropriately.
Oh man, I have my own personal story about this that might be too soon to tell, but at a previous role, we had recently hired a VP of engineering, and I reported to him, and perhaps against my better judgment, and something I had done previously was I emailed to the company, our entire company email list, that we were going to be doing a short period of database maintenance. So the website or various parts of our website would be read-only. And I sent that to the entire company without consulting the VP of engineering who was recently hired in above me. And he replies all. And he has a, I won't say it's like a impolite tone, but it was a pretty disrespectful tone. And I could tell that he probably didn't mean to reply all. And I take ownership for not communicating with him before sending the email originally, but man, that was really brutal. And I remember that I had a hard time biting the bullet and respecting him as much as I should have in the role that I was in beneath him. So... I'm sure I've committed this sin of the wrongly sent email, but damn, I wish there were better tools for this.
Yeah. I do know with a lot of sales group that use products like Yesware or Lead Genius that actually take care of a lot of this micromanagement. I don't know how effective they are with grammar and everything else, whatever.
Yeah, not very. Although Gmail these days, they have a feature for undo send, which works better than Outlook.
Go into your Gmail settings immediately, set an undo send, and set it for, say, 20 seconds. 10 seconds is enough sometimes. That has saved my bacon more than a few times.
Yeah. Speaking of tools, there's another one that I've used recently called Hemingway app, which highlights... If you copy-paste your text into it, it'll highlight overuse of adjectives and complex sentences, so you can really easily trim down what you've written so that it doesn't sound like such a...
It's really funny. So Hemingway, it's called Hemingway App. So Hemingway was pretty famous for his editing of his writing, where he would go through and remove every single excessive word to distill down his actual books, his writing that he has. So that makes total sense.
Ernest Hemingway, the super famous American author who, he's got a very succinct writing style. And in business emails, whether it's sales or even internal to your software engineering team that you're working on, makes a lot of sense to try and make your communications clear rather than right. ambivalent. So,
and just the counterexample of this, I had a colleague at NOAA who, when you'd email him a question, I don't know if he's... He'd respond with a book, right? I would email him a simple question, I would get 10 paragraphs back. Well, that kind of communication just flat out didn't make me want to interact with him. Like, I don't have time to parse this 12 paragraph of prose to figure out what the answer was to what I asked, right? So, like, making your communication succinct, you're not wasting someone else's time, and you're getting to the point quickly is also an important reason to, you know, to keep your communication on point.
So not so far ago, we interviewed a senior technical recruiter, asking her a few questions about how candidates should manage their communications with recruiters. So having been doing this for a long time and having held a number of jobs, you must have dealt with recruiters. What are the idiosyncrasies of communicating with recruiters, whether they're internal recruiters, meaning employees of the company that's hiring, or contract recruiters,
right.
who are people who make a commission when you take a job that they place you into?
Right. So Max is talking about Ruby. Ruby was actual internal recruiter at Lead Genius. You brought me on.
Mm-hmm.
She was effective, right? I have yet to have a job. I've gotten interviews from external recruiters, but internal recruiters, they have a different kind of compensation scheme that makes them more apt to communicate with you appropriately, right? I take a position with technical recruiters here in the Bay Area. It's dog eat dog. Like, they would flip you just like real estate agents flip houses every 6 months if they possibly can. Typically in the tech world, I've had trouble with external recruiters because of the way they're incentivized, right? So if I had one particular job at a company which I could have taken, but essentially they in the Bay Area, I think I'll go ahead and say I think I was getting an offer for like $130,000 at this job. I was asking for $160,000. The problem is that $30,000 difference went to the recruiter instead. So it added an arbitrary glass ceiling on my potential comp.
Yeah.
So when you're looking at external recruiters, these people typically, you know, they're good talkers. They're very outgoing people, but they're just there to make sure that you move into that job for 6 months so they get their payout. There's no other reason that they're doing what they're doing. Internal recruiters have a little bit more incentive. They're actually employed by a company. They know the company much better to actually bring you in and work.
Have you found that the jobs that you've been that you've ever interviewed for or considered, that employers have been happier to interview you and quicker to make an offer when you did not come to them through a contract recruiter?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a There are problems with contract recruiters, too. There are two positions you can take. I have a colleague of mine who allows any recruiter onto his LinkedIn network as possible, right? His position is that it essentially makes his network much larger. I don't want to deal with this. Like, I get emailed daily with job offers. Typically, the contract recruiters are sort of, they're not competent in tech, right? And to have to explain to some contract recruiter in Michigan what the difference is between JavaScript and Java is a waste of my time. It's a waste of anyone's time. If these people can't do their jobs properly and they're just trying to look for the next paycheck, you get a lot of sort of burst communication like that. Internal recruiters, companies, they know what they want and they're going to be a lot more on target. That being said, I do know some people that have gone through contract recruiters are doing fine, but it's really, it depends upon your perspective, your approach. I just don't want to deal with it because I've had no success in the past with this actual contract recruiters.
Yeah, in my experience, this is anecdotal. I don't have a lot of data to prove this, but I definitely think that, or have observed that, employers are faster to move to offer stage if you've come to them through means that don't involve a contract recruiter who wants 10, 15, 20% of your first year salary.
Yeah.
So that's something to keep in mind when you are considering employers that you really want to work for. If you don't have to go through a contract recruiter who's reached out to you, you can apply through your website or their website, or preferably find a friend or a friend of a friend, even loosely related people to you in your life, are a better signal to the employer you're applying to than a contract recruiter about your candidacy and your eligibility for the role they want to hire for. So this is something that I find really interesting about hiring in engineering, is that internal referrals, where a current employee refers somebody, speak volumes about the candidate, because internal employees have a lot of skin in the game.
Yep.
If their friend who they refer gets hired and they suck, not only do they have a shitty person on their team, but now they look bad because they've brought somebody on board that they should have warned about. So to hiring managers, when you're job searching, to hiring managers, it looks very good, very favorable when you have some type of referral for this reason.
Absolutely. And I've been in a position before where I was actually emailed about the same job by two different recruiters. Then I had to get involved with them bickering back and forth, saying, okay, fine, this one actually did email me first, so the position was going to him. This guy, essentially, I did get a job offer for this job, and the guy actually told me to like just stay at the company for 6 months to get his so he could get his paycheck. I turned that job down, and I don't interface with that person at all anymore. So again, they're like used car salesmen. You have to be very careful about who you're interacting with. Sometimes what you can do is you can actually get they'll be very cagey about the job offers they're sending in emails, like work for this new Series C level company to change the world. And you're like, well, who's that? Well, sometimes there are enough clues there where you can actually go to the website, find the job that's actually posted on the website, and take that approach. What that does is it raises your amount of money that you're going to get, because there's no recruiter fee, and also completely circumvents the recruiter nonsense.
On the other hand, this is a very controversial topic, and this is how recruiters make their money. And to any recruiters watching, we apologize. we understand how hard your job is. On the other hand, it's a conflict of interest, and better to make this information public than it is to try and conceal it.
And this is business as well. I mean, I'm looking to get my maximum amount of money for my employment as possible. And if that means undercutting...
Oh my God!
It's like capitalism 101. Amazing.
Yeah.
So it's if it's in my best interest to take that approach, then I'm going to do what I have to do.
Yeah.
But again, Ruby was great. Wonderful. Internal recruiters, yes. External recruiters, no.
Yeah. So, I mean, any other topics we want to cover? I mean, we've covered a lot of ground. Go for it.
Good. So whenever I've transitioned through a lot of jobs. Only one job have I left under a year, and that was for financial reasons, right? Try and stay in your position for an entire year at least. Longer if you can. That's here in the Bay Area, that's understood, that happens. What that allows you to do, though, when you transition like that, I have absorbed so many skill sets from the companies and people I've worked for that it's made me a far stronger, far more employable engineer. Additionally, try and increase your base salary by a minimum of 15% between each job. This allows you to really kind of climb up into the higher brackets of employment. It allows you to do stuff like start a family in the Bay Area, where rent's $3,000 a month, and houses are in general, I think, $1.2 million in San Francisco now.
Something like that.
That's a median house salary. You can't do that if you're making under six figures, guys. So definitely, you make sure you're always making more money at your next job. And definitely don't feel cagey about leaving a job after a year. It's the best way to build skill sets by going and seeing new people using those skill sets.
I think one of the topics that we should definitely do another interview about some point in the near future is on the topic of when to know when to leave your job.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that people make a lot of mistakes about, is either leaving a job too soon for a relatively minor raise. You got to think about how you're curating your resume. And for the long term, do you have a pattern of sticking with situations to the point where you have tenure in an organization and you have clout? Because there's a lot of benefits to staying with an organization for more than 2 years, let's say.
But also, like, earlier in your career, maybe not so much benefit. Later in your career, yes, right? I'm at Twilio right now. I expect to be at Twilio for quite some time. I've kind of, my skill set is where I need to be. I'm an effective engineer. I can knock stuff out so fast. But I'm also at a point where I've got a family to raise. So moving around so much isn't really on my radar anymore.
Cool. Yeah. So I hope we do this again very soon. Yeah. This has been a tremendous amount of helpful information for people who may be starting their careers and their first few jobs and may not know what we've talked about in regards to recruiters and the different roles there are as an alternative to being just a software engineer, like a sales engineer or solutions architect. So thank you, Josh. Cheers. That's been fucking awesome. Appreciate it.
Cheers, Max.